Welcome to Boat Talk. This is your host, Peter Guerrero, for KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend, Washington. Today, my guest is Erdan Eroç, who is the Chief Exploration Officer of Around and Over, a nonprofit to educate and inspire youth. Erdan was here recently in Port Townsend to give a talk at the Northwest Maritime Center. A former software developer, project manager, and mechanical engineer by training, he found the confines of the corporate world and life in a cubicle too confining and, quite frankly, too depressing to imagine this would be how he would spend the rest of his life. In 1997, daydreaming about a circumnavigation of the world by human power, he imagined a route that would take him halfway across the world to the top of Mount Everest, up and down, and then back to where he started. Welcome, Erdan.
Thank you for the introduction.
What did I miss there?
Not much, really. That was a very good summary, I thought.
So how do you take the first step in leaving the corporate world behind and realizing your dream, particularly when the typical response is an incredulous, well, have you ever done this before?
That kind of transition does not happen easy. We all have our commitments and we all have our excuses before we commit to following our dreams. And I was a software engineer with a life in the city, career aspirations and educational goals, financial goals with a mortgage to pay. And those were, at the time, convenient excuses to postpone things, and daydreaming was just enough for a while. But when I had an accident while climbing together with a friend, he fell and he died in Eastern Washington at Frenchman Coulee, I thought life was short and I had to get going.
And his and name,
no more excuses.
Yeah, he was Goran Krupp, a Swede.
That's correct.
He was quite a outdoorsman. He had bicycled from Sweden to Nepal and then climbed Everest without Sherpas, motorized support, or even supplemental oxygen. And when you first met him, he actually, instead of asking you, well, have you ever done this before, what was his response to your dream?
He understood what I was wanting to do and the scope of what I was going to do, and he challenged me really in his subtle prodding of me to get going. His question was, when are you starting? Do you have sponsors? And that's really the bottom line.
So he got you thinking about the practicality of realizing this this dream.
Absolutely. He held up a mirror and said, when are you starting? That's a big loaded question.
Indeed.
And unless we take that first step in a journey of 1,000 steps, right, as the proverbial expression goes, we will never make progress.
In addition to Krupp, there were others whose lives were an inspiration to you. Emil Kassov, Francis Olding or two. Who were these individuals and what was their impact on you?
Emil Kosev was a rowing coach from Bulgaria. I'm originally from Turkey, and he'd call me komşu, meaning neighbor. we'd joke around. He was the coach for the Olympic rowing team, U.S. Olympic rowing team. And when I approached him about what I was going to do, he told me, you're crazy, but I'll help you. And that was the end of that. And he would keep an eye on me among all his other athlete responsibilities. Francis Olding was a person who heard my story. He was a lawyer, and I was trying to formulate how I was going to proceed, whether to incorporate as a for-profit or a non-profit, and he took me over to our legal counsel, Chris Bevere, who later became our legal counsel, actually, and we set up the nonprofit Around and Over. Those were the two that were instrumental in my beginnings. Another person that inspired me was Tom Hornbein, and I had read his book, the article about the 1963 Everest ascent when I was in high school. And reading that, I came across the Hornbein couloir. The name stuck with me. And later on, when I moved to Seattle, I had the opportunity to go on a hike with him. And it was a very touching moment for me. Had come full circle to be able to connect with my hero in that way.
Many of these inspirational people in your life did die relatively young. What was your take on that when it came to deciding that it was the right time to go forward with your own dream?
Well, I was not getting younger, and there was certainly the prospect that I would not maintain my physical abilities forever. So there is certainly that pressure to move on. And also, by doing the same things over and over every day, we really are not changing anything, are we?
It seems to, I mean, by nature, we're creatures who seem to find reasons for staying in place, inertia.
Well, I personally like routine, and I'm a creature of habit. Most of us are. And the familiar is easier to accept. And then before we realize it, years pass by, and we have not made a move. And challenging ourselves in such ways is really how we can break that inertia.
So already you have this dream of a circumnavigation under human power and climbing Everest, but then you decide to add five more peaks, Denali, Kilimanjaro, and a few others. So you're not only crossing the Pacific Ocean, the Indian Ocean, and the Atlantic Ocean. It's now become quite an endeavor. How did you decide to add these additional peaks?
As we had mentioned, Neuron had bicycled from Stockholm to Nepal in '96, and he had towed his climbing gear there and climbed Everest solo, as chronicled in Into Thin Air, and his the book about him as well is Ultimate High. So it's a good read. Having lived through his fall and his death on my watch, on my belay, I was moved on the way back from his funeral in Stockholm to add the highest summit on each continent to my project. So I drew the world map on a piece of paper and connected the dots, details to be determined later. And Six Summits Project was born.
So this the additional summits was a memorial to him?
Correct. So the closest summit to reach for was McKinley in Alaska. I bicycled from Seattle to Petersville, and then snowshoed. Petersville is south of McKinley in Alaska. In winter conditions, February 1st through April 15th to 11th to Talkeetna, and then May 1st, we started hiking in from Petersville toward the mountain. We walked the length of the Kahilna Glacier with snowshoes, towing the gear on a sled. I bicycled there, towing my climbing gear as well, Yaron style. And we reached the summit 29th of May. So it was February 1st through May 29th. Quite busy times for me in 2003. So that was the first summit. And then I married my wife in Homer, Alaska. She flew home, and I bicycled back.
So once you start putting your dream out there and these individuals who are encouraging you to pursue it, you're also getting some very practical advice from them. It's when will you start? Who's going to sponsor you? Etc. So planning for a ocean crossing, for example, in a open boat requires an understanding of trade winds, weather, anticipating seasonal storms and ocean swells, paying attention to commercial navigation traffic, an insane amount of logistics. What were the steps that you went through to actually launch your boat?
I first had to obtain a boat. I had two options. I could build a boat from scratch that would be pedal driven with a propeller, or I could have a rowboat. I came across Ocean Rowing Society in London, and they had used standard kit boats that were available for sale. And we found a boat in a good condition over there in the UK, and we shipped it from there. She was built in 2001 by two British men who rowed from Canary Islands to Barbados, and then a mother-daughter team rowed the same route in 2004. And then I took over the boat and rowed her in 2006 from Canary Islands to Guadeloupe solo in 96 days. So that was the first crossing that I did. Leading up to that, I read a couple of books by rowers, ocean rowers. I read online accounts. I tried to talk to other rowers. I traveled to Sweden to talk to an ocean rower and to spend time with him. And he shared a lot of his experience, and I answered my questions. And I started thinking about what could go wrong and tried to come up with ways to address them, tried to imagine life out there. I was already exposed to outdoors since age 11, and I was teaching navigation with the Mountaineers. Of course, we were using maps, right? And when I tried to get navigation courses from StarPath here, there was a bit of a ridicule suggesting that I should not do what I was doing. It was crazy. So I decided to get navigation books myself and started calling maps, charts, and I was on my way. I joined the Seattle Salem Power Squadron. They were offering courses, and I started building up my knowledge specific to oceans. At some point, though, all of these are nice, but at some point one has to really untie from the pier and
I can imagine that as you go through all these risk management steps, which make a lot of sense, and all of these extraordinary journeys, particularly the solo journey you were planning, require a lot of risk calculations and planning and information. But there's also a point where you might get stuck with that and never actually do what you're intending to do.
Absolutely. Paralysis by analysis is a very real phenomenon. And at some point, one needs to have the courage to step with the unknowns. And that's where the adventure part comes in. We don't have all the answers at the beginning.
So let's fast forward to Bodega Bay, which is July 20, 2007. After several unsuccessful attempts to launch through the Golden Gate, you're finally on your way. What was on your mind at that point?
I launched from Bodega Bay 10th of July, 2007, actually. I had tried to launch out of Golden Gate twice before, and once we had to turn the boat back and tow it in, and then second, I was under the Golden Gate Bridge at the Presidio Yacht Club and not leaving because it was already getting to be June, and cold currents outside of the gate were producing onshore winds. It was just getting difficult. So
the very famous San Francisco summer fog.
Right. That was a routine thing in the mornings. And it was getting to the point where I was thinking I might not be able to leave. I had sort of planned my crossing thinking, well, I need to be southwest of Hawaii, near Marshall Islands, come January, February, so that the northwest monsoons would sweep me into the southern hemisphere, and with that I could come around Caledonia and approach, or perhaps pass south of the Solomon Islands and approach Australia that way. My goal was to get to Australia. Having made these calculations based on 30 miles a day, 1,000 miles a month rule of thumb, I decided that I should leave in May sometime, later in May. But the winds were just not letting me out. I should have left earlier. So the later that the season was getting for my departure, the more risk I was going to take with possible hurricanes coming out near Baja, south of Baja, and advancing toward Hawaii. So I would have been on hurricane tracks, and I did not want to take that chance. My deadline was July 15, and finally, July 10, I was able to leave when a low-pressure system formed and advanced north toward Bodega Bay, giving me offshore winds, actually, instead of onshore winds, and totally disrupted the northwest trades. And with that, I was able to launch out 70, 80 miles directly west.
It must have been a great relief to finally be out at sea.
Absolutely. And I did pass south of a hurricane that formed northeast of me eventually a month later. So it was touch and go for a while.
And you're listening to Boat Talk on KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend's eclectic, authentic community radio station. This is your host of Boat Talk, Peter Guerrero, and today I'm interviewing Erdan Uruk, who circumnavigated the globe under human power. By your calculation, you start at Bodega Bay in 2007. 5 years later, you've gone some 41,000 miles, and you calculated some 26 million strokes of the oars.
That was a rough test.
This was a journey that you said, in your own words, required a clarity of purpose, a steadiness at the helm. And you just mentioned the hurricane that passes north of you. What were some of the challenging aspects of this voyage?
Just being ready for everything that could go wrong is a huge pressure, and it takes a great deal of mental fortitude to be able to even fathom such an undertaking. It takes audacity, I think, to dream that, yes, I could succeed. And it was hard to convince others to the possibility that, yes, I could succeed in this. And possibly for that reason, I didn't have too many sponsors. And again, as I suggested earlier, there were no more excuses after Huron's accident. So I decided to, with the blessings of my wife, we cashed out my 401k and we downsized our life. We had a Lakeview condo on Lake Union. We moved away a bit and cut our mortgage commitment by half. We had a second car. We sold that. So we organized our lives so that we could live on one salary in my absence. And with the limited sponsorships that I did have, I was able to take off. So being able to make these sacrifices, if you will, or choices is a better word for it, we are able to get to the starting line. One has to have the audacity to say, yes, I can, and then have the courage to take the first step. There has to be a whole lot of determination, perseverance, problem-solving abilities, dealing with the unexpected, and the flexibility to be able to change the plans and not being so stubborn that one gets in trouble, rather than being determined to keep the bigger goal in mind and being able to meander a bit to work around local difficulties.
It strikes me, Erdan, that your voyage, it can also be described as a vision quest, where typically a young person sets out from their community, their known place in the world, to discover a larger horizon, to have their resourcefulness tested, and ultimately to discover themselves so that when they return, they are better able to contribute their unique talents to their community. What did you discover in your own vision quest about yourself and your place in the world?
That vision quest idea was actually acknowledged during my travels north through the First Nations territories in British Columbia, for example, when people would bring their children and say, tell them about your vision. One thing that I did learn was that as important as we think we are in society and staying put to serve those who need us, we tend to sacrifice our dreams and, in a way, become heroes in our own minds. That's a false argument, I think. I would like to think that those who love us, those who surround us, want us to succeed and to achieve our dreams just as we want them to do the same. We sacrifice our own resources to help them go forward, and they want to do the same for us. So if we only admit it to our own dreams in their presence, they become the best support network for us, and they give us the shoulder to proceed, and they will push us forward. I think that was a strong lesson that I learned.
It's actually a wonderful vision of relationships among people, that each of us is here really to support each other and to bring out the best and what each other is meant to uniquely contribute to this life.
Absolutely. And if we strive for the biggest dream possible and not shortchange ourselves and admit to it in public in the presence of our loved ones, they will support us to achieve that, just as we would for them to do the same thing. And also I found out that my journey actually was the glue that held this whole thing together. It sounds trivial, sounds like a tautology perhaps. The journey became the goal, really. At the beginning, yeah, I was the one doing all these wonderful things. For a while, it could have been about me. But when I took a step back and started talking about the journey to those I encountered along the journey became the glue that attracted everybody along the way. Everybody wanted to be part of that journey. It was upholding that journey that served me well. I was the one pulling it. I was its voice. I was its face. I was the one pushing it, pulling it, the engine for it. And when I came into these villages in the far corners of Papua New Guinea or in the better developed parts of Australia, it didn't matter. It always was unique to see a loaded bicycle with a trailer or a kayak with bright yellow orange colors or a rowboat with the bright yellow color that it had. I was unique. I had a story to tell, and I needed help, and people wanted to know more. By helping and by being involved, they got to own my journey, and they became part of it. And their story is now my story as well.
And an important part of your journey is your foundation's work to support global education and convey these empowering messages to young people. Could you describe some of these projects?
We established the 501c3 nonprofit around and over in Seattle back in 2003, effective January 1st, 2003, just before I was to ride up to Alaska to climb McKinley. Before I started my circumnavigation, all these quests for the summits, I thought about it and I said, well, this could be a chest-beating exercise, making a name for myself, or we could create value for society. We decided that a 501c3 structure would be a better way to go, and we could set our mission to be to educate and inspire children, school children, and to do educational projects in developing communities that I would visit. One of the projects that we have going for now, for example, is to build additional classrooms at the Matevis Secondary School in Arusha, Tanzania, on the foothills of Kilimanjaro. That mountain I climbed after rowing to Africa from Australia back in 2011. In June 2011, I climbed it with my wife and my then 79-year-old father, who had taken me up my first mountain when I was 11. It was a wonderful experience, and our teammates raised funds to build two more classrooms at this secondary school. They need a dozen classrooms. That's one of the projects, for example, a primary project that we've had since the get-go has been to find resources for primary school students in boarding schools in rural Turkey. We have a partner foundation there, IKEA Foundation, that we trust, and we are able to direct funds to them so that basic needs of these students can be provided. So those two are good examples to what we've done with the funds raised as well.
Being an environmentalist, when I was listening to your presentation here at the Northwest Maritime Center in Port Townsend, my ears perked up when you talked about the very serious issues of ocean pollution, particularly by plastics. Could you elaborate on what you saw?
The plastic that does end up in the seas by deliberate dumping or by what's thrown in the collected in the rivers and out into the sea, these plastic bits become brittle at sea by exposure to UV, and then by mechanical action of the waves, they break down, and then they will eventually break down all the way down to a polymer soup, really. And the plastics have the quality to attract toxins, such as PCBs, so they become concentrators of such pollution. And if they appear like food to any creature out there, like fish, if they ingest that, then the same toxins would end up in their fatty tissues and stay there forever for life. So the top echelons of the food chain, like the dolphins or the orcas, have a lot of pollutants in their system.
And even more insidious than that, it's these small plastic particles that almost are at a polymer level. These are often mistaken for food, and they're ingested, and different species actually die of starvation?
Absolutely. So these pollutants can come in and clog up the gills of the fish. It can be ingested by these creatures. For example, if a sea turtle saw a clear plastic bag, it would think that were a jellyfish and start eating that. And of course, if it ate plastic, can't digest it, it won't pass. So it would fill up its gut with plastic clutter, and there would be no room left for real food, and that would lead to starvation.
You've been listening to Boat Talk, produced by KPTZ Community Radio in Port Townsend, Washington, and streaming at kptz.org. Your host is Peter Guerrero, and I've been talking to Erdan Uruk, a man who, in his own words, is in the business of realizing dreams and helping others achieve theirs. On his website, Around and Over, he says, "There are dreams that never go away. They live inside us. We learn to live with them. We tuck them away. We try to ignore them. We have commitments. We feel guilty to even consider those dreams. Sometimes we indulge, lifting our eyes off the pages of a magazine with colorful pictures and gaze into the distance. These dreams most often define the true individual inside us that wants to come alive." Any closing thoughts, Erdan?
Well, let's not postpone our dreams. Let's find a way to take that first step and commit. Without commitment, dreams never come alive, and we never live up to our true potential.
Erdan, thank you.
With that, I'd like to thank you.
Yes, Erdan, thank you so much for being our guest on Boat Talk. I really enjoyed our conversation today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.